Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio State President Dr. Michael Drake steps into the role of President Emeritus this week after 6 years at the helm. Dr. Drake departs as OSU, along with higher education institutions across the country, confront huge challenges, financial and academic. Incoming OSU President Christina Johnson, Chancellor of the State University of New York, starts her new job here on September 1st. Dr. Drake joins us right now, though. Welcome back.
Good morning, Ann. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Doing very well, thank you.
You are taking a sabbatical year before you come back to teach, which the timing on that, all things being equal, isn't so bad given the pandemic and everything.
Well, you know, I'll say this, you know, our plans for the future were things that have been evolving really over a year, and it looked a lot different in February and early March than it does now, actually. And I think we're all working hard to try to, really all of us in every phase of our lives are working to try and cope with the new realities that we're dealing with. And I'm pleased from my role in here at the university that the leadership team is really strong, and Christina Johnson's a great choice. I think everybody's going to be thrilled with her, and
you know,
I'm very pleased that she's coming in.
With no reference to her per se, because it doesn't really have anything to do with her, but do you regret maybe making this the year of the change, given the upheaval and so forth?
Well, you know, I think for all of us, the upheaval is upheaval, and if you would have asked me how things were on March 1st, I would have said it was perfect. You know, we'd never been stronger. We had if you looked at the major things that we measure, the interest in students, our graduation rates, student debt, our research profile, on and on across the board, we were stronger than we'd ever been and doing great and moving up. So we were in tremendous shape. And so it seemed like at that time, a perfect time to be handing off a baton. So I think that all was, so that timing and everything were just right. And it felt about time. It was, you know, time for us to make our next chapter or start our next chapter. So that all was doing fine. And then I'd say two things happened, really. The world, you know, turned upside down with the pandemic, which we're still dealing with. I mean, we still all have much work to do with the pandemic. And then, you know, the month of the beginning of June, end of May, beginning of June, were very difficult. Because we, as a country, one of the things the pandemic exposed to us was things we saw in every day in small ways, but it was, again, put in our face the inequities in our society and who was suffering from this. And that then was overlaid with the George Floyd killing and Black Lives Matter issues, which have always been there, but having a new focus, a new light. And so yeah, I think we've all done a lot of evaluating of our role and what we're doing and how we can continue to help things move forward.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Dr. Michael Drake, president of Ohio State University for one more day, is with us. Not that we're counting. And and he's only with us for one segment, so sorry about that. Who's going to be making the decisions? You're leaving within a few days. Christina Johnson doesn't start until September 1st. Who's in the middle there?
Yeah, so a couple things. First, Bruce McFerrin is our provost. And Bruce, you've known for a long time, and Bruce has been a part of the university for decades. He's an alum and grew up in Ohio, was an alum of this university, and has been our provost now since for 4 years. And so that's great. He's had a real solid run with us and really knows every aspect of the university inside out, was a dean before he was provost. And then Hal Paz is the executive vice president and chancellor of the health system, and so he's overseeing the hospitals and that side. And then our board chair, Gary Heminger, is going to be involved in helping to be here kind of in the middle of those things, for things that come between those two areas and or in the middle a bit, he'll be able to carry those things forward. So I think that triumvirate is going to be who we have leading. I'll say the other thing is that knowing how these jobs are before you start, you're already involved a bit, and we've already been talking, not to rope her in or say anything, Bob, but, you know, Christina is also, you know, available by phone and things. And
yeah.
I know when I was starting here, I was in telephone meetings and other things when we had decisions that were going to affect the future, starting months before I actually came to Columbus. And so I think we have a great group of leaders who will take things forward. And let me say that just below that great group of leaders, we have dozens, and then below them, hundreds of really outstanding people who, and then below them, thousands. I mean, I don't mean to stop at any place. It's really, we have a really great enterprise that's working quite well. So we're going to be fine.
You know, it's funny when I think back to when you first arrived amid the maelstrom of the marching band controversy, the sexualization, blah, 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 all of that stuff. And it was, you know, a huge story. It was a really, really big story here. Yeah. And it probably messed with your head for quite a while. And now look at us now, you know, 6 years later and boom, it's here we are all over again. But now it's just funny how our perspective, you know, changes.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, that was kind of the beginnings of what I would think sort of rolled into the Me Too movement and the and other things that have happened in the past year that have come forward were the beginnings of people who had maybe didn't have the voice that they wish being able to have a voice.
And Dr. Strauss, that
about how they've been treated. Yeah. Dr. Strauss is what I was thinking of. And so it took a lot. And all those were really connected. It took a lot for those individuals to come forward and say, hey, take a look at how I'm being treated and the opportunities I have. And is this okay? And is this right? And, you know, we just tried to tried to shine light on what the facts and the truth were and to move forward. And my view is that we are entirely stronger for having done such things. But I know some may have a different point of view, but my view is that we, knowing what the truth is and knowing what our history is and confronting that, is the only way that we can create a better future. And so I would have preferred that, you know, we would have started with things that were easier or less challenging for the new guy to come in and deal with. But, you know, you have to take it as it lays. And I've always believed in trying to gather data, make good decisions, and to be transparent and to move forward. And I feel that we're much stronger as a university, and broadly, we're making ourselves stronger as a society as we face these things that we know are there, but we maybe don't focus enough time and attention on.
You have been supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement. You've been supportive of the proposal for an independent citizens review board by the mayor.
Yes.
You've asked for a student representative to serve on that. Why?
Yes. Oh, I think that the student perspective and the perspective of young people is incredibly important. You know, I grew up in this country. I began in segregated schools and segregated neighborhoods, and throughout the time that I was in high school, there were places I couldn't go, and I remember that clearly. And you know, places I couldn't go, people I couldn't talk to, things that I couldn't do that were just normal things to do. So everyone in my generation has lived through this. I've been stopped, I don't know, a dozen times perhaps over the years. The sum total of what I was doing when I was stopped all those times that was inappropriate was nothing. So for no reason, whatever, but I looked suspicious. So I've been stopped at airports dozens of times for no reason, but an African-American man traveling alone must be carrying drugs or doing something else that's wrong. And then I had a time when I was traveling with my younger son. It's 20 years ago now, but he was an outstanding runner in high school, and he got invited to a special national meet for the best runners in the country, and it was a great deal. We were feeling great about ourselves. We got to the airport, and there was a regular, you know, line to be, this is prior to TSA, a line to get onto the airport. It was long. And I remember that there were two lines. We're going in the same plane, and for fun, we took different lines. And I was in one, he was in the other. And then they went around corners, and then I got pulled out of the line to take into a room to be searched for no reason. And then I was standing there, and then a moment or two later, my son gets pulled in from another door to be searched. I couldn't have been. I'm horrified and disgusted by it now. We were the only two African-Americans in the line of 100 people here and there, and we got pulled out independently for air quotes, them check. And so that's the, I have this, so I know this experience that young people feel. I've grown through it. It's horrific. It's horrible. It's awful for any of us to have to go around and carry that. Mm-hmm. And we just need to confront this head on and once and for all get it aside. It's way too much. It's too long. It's disgusting. So first, that's the first part. The second part is, I think that our students are thoughtful, responsible adults. You know, since we've been here, we work to give students a vote on the Board of Trustees. They act in a totally responsible way and have an outstanding perspective. And I think the city and the police need to hear from young people about what their behavior does to them and how they can kind of think carefully about being able to do a better job of keeping us all safe without the intimidation and disrespect that they show far too many people and far too many people of color too often. If you want to know my opinion about it.
I sure do.
Yeah,
You know, I'd only have you for a few more minutes. And Mary, a listener, emailed a question that I was going to ask you, and I'll let her ask it. She says, Dr. Drake, I'm very scared that Columbus will have a dreadful spike in COVID when OSU isn't back in session. A friend who works at another local university tells me that the kids are not careful with the pandemic. Mary, now I'll add in, you referenced thoughtful, responsible adults, the young people that go to OSU, but
they're also, I'll say that human beings are social animals. And if we look at the world, but let's look at the United States, infections are person-to-person spread overwhelmingly. So all the people that we see that are infected, the million people, that all comes from person-to-person spread. And new people who are infected coming into the hospital a week or two from now are getting infected today and tomorrow. So we as a society broadly have to behave differently if we're going to be able to get back to normal anytime soon. And that means doing those things that we know work to suppress the virus while we're waiting for science to catch up and let us get back to our as close to our old ways as we were. And that means wearing a mask when you go out. There are two sides to this. There's wearing a mask or there's promoting spread of the virus, and there's no in between. So that's period. And then washing one's hands and doing everything that one can to maintain appropriate physical distance. People overwhelmingly are not good at this. We know that young people are not particularly good at this, but older people as well. I see people not respecting social distance and going around, and some people defiantly saying, "I'm not going to wear a mask."
Right.
The virus thanks you. What's the virus going to do? That because you don't want to wear a mask, it's going to say, "Great, you're a subject for me to infect, and then you can infect somebody else." And if we can open the paper today and tomorrow and see that happening. So I think all of us have to take responsibility for ourselves if we're going to be able to get society back to normal.
What is your, to let this all go, what is your thoughts about football restarting up again in the fall?
Same thing about, football and normal commerce and our economy and our health are all tied together. And it really is the behavior of the American citizenry. And if you like football and if you like the economy, if you are pro-health in life, then you'll act in a responsible way. You'll wear a mask when you're in public. You'll keep physical distance and you'll wash your hands often. If you don't like those things, then you'll behave in another way. I've watched people behave in other ways, and the virus is just waiting for you to do that. What more can I say?
And there's always the reruns. Buckeye fans love reruns. Dr. Michael Drake, I'm sorry I can't see you in person. It's been a privilege interviewing you over the years. I wish you every best thing in life with you and your spouse, Brenda, going forward. Congratulations on your retirement and congratulations on your next chapter.
Well, we're looking forward to the next adventure, and it's always been great talking with you. What a great community we have. We are going to get through this together, and we're going to come out strong, and I'm looking forward to the future.
Take care. Stay in touch.
Thank you, for sure. Take care, Ann.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
That's OSU President Dr. Michael Drake. Today is his last day, official last day on the job. Coming up, we are going to talk about that recent Supreme Court ruling. It was a big, major victory for the Trump administration and its quest to speed up deportation of thousands of undocumented immigrants. We'll talk about that and the impact it will have on immigration going forward. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The U.S. Supreme Court last week delivered the Trump administration a major victory in its quest to speed up deportation of thousands of undocumented immigrants. In a 7-2 ruling, the court said that asylum seekers who are picked up at the border and whose cases are quickly rejected by U.S. immigration officials are not entitled to a day in court. Lucas Gutentag teaches immigration law at Stanford Law School and Yale Law School. Previously was a senior advisor in the Department of Homeland Security under President Obama. He founded the American Civil Liberties Union Immigrants' Rights Project. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
You bet. Attorney Lee Gelernt is a deputy director of the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. He argued the case before the Supreme Court in March. Welcome to the show, Lee.
Having me.
So, Lee, tell us about your client, the plaintiff in this case. What was his story?
So, he is from Sri Lanka, and he's Tamil, a historically persecuted ethnic minority. He's a serious danger in Sri Lanka, and the most recent episode involved men.
Lee, we are going to have somebody call you and reset this phone call. It's not coming through clearly, so stand by for that. Let me turn to Lucas Gutentag. The Supreme Court's ruling upholds a 1996 law that established deportation procedures known as expedited removal. And Justice Samuel Alito, in his majority opinion, said that Congress was entitled to respond to the crisis of the immigration being overwhelmed with that law. How has expedited removal been used before and after President Trump took office, Lucas Gutentag?
Well, expedited removal has been in place since 1996. It's been significantly expanded by President Trump, although that was enjoined until very recently. But the critical question here really is the way in which and the extent to which courts can review wrongful determinations by individuals who are subject to this expedited removal regime who have claims to asylum. For the most part, expedited removal can be applied to someone who's arriving at the border without valid documents and can be summarily expelled. But if they have a valid claim to asylum, they have to go through a screening process where they're entitled to show that they should be allowed to apply for asylum. And if they pass that screening process, then they go through a full asylum hearing. The question here is whether when the government determines, when DHS agents, CBP, Border Patrol agents determine that a person fails to meet that threshold screening to qualify for a full asylum hearing, whether a court can review that decision to make sure that the government has complied with the law, has applied the right legal standard, and is not wrongfully returning someone like Mr. Thurasigam to persecution without the opportunity to get a hearing.
How many, is there a sense about how many people this could affect going forward?
Well, it's difficult to say because it's very hard to know exactly how many people are going through the expedited removal process and then how many people are being denied at this threshold, so-called credible fear screening phase, but and how often the government violates the law and how often individuals can then go to court. But it's in the thousands or tens of thousands of individuals who are subjected to the expedited removal process and the credible fear screening process if they make out a claim or claim for asylum. So it's very significant in terms of removing an entire part of the expulsion process from judicial oversight. And that's what's significant about this, as well as the larger implications.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about the U.S. Supreme Court decision last week that says that asylum seekers who are picked up at the border and whose cases are quickly rejected by U.S. immigration officials are not entitled to a day in court to appeal those decisions. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You just heard Lucas Gutentag. He teaches immigration law at Stanford and Yale Law Schools, and he is founded the American Civil Liberties Union Immigrants' Rights Project. Also with us, Lee Gallant. He is an attorney and the deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project. Lee Gallant, tell us, you argued the case before the Supreme Court. Tell us about your client and what's his story.
Yeah, so he is Sri Lankan Tamil, which is a historically persecuted group in Sri Lanka, and he was abducted and beaten. He came to the United States, fled danger, he was fearing for his life, got to the United States, had one of these fast-track truncated hearings without an attorney, a very short hearing, but importantly, the asylum officer believed everything that Mr. Thrasingham was telling the asylum officer, so believed about, understood the abduction and the beatings, but said, well, I'm legally not going to grant you asylum. And so that's the type of situation where you would want to be able to go into court and say there was a legal error. I mean, I think that's what most people in this country would think. Well, if the asylum officer ultimately is part of the executive branch headed by the president, decides you're not legally entitled to something, you should have your day in court. And interestingly, although the Supreme Court said the federal courts don't have jurisdiction over these issues, it did say that the facts of Mr. Thrasingham's case clearly resembled the type of persecution that occurs in Sri Lanka toward Tamils, and that maybe he should have a rehearing by the government. And I think what that suggests is that there are real flaws in the system. How big an impact this case has, I think, will depend a little on whether the Trump administration continues to eviscerate the asylum protections, the underlying asylum protections. But Congress can always step in, and hopefully Congress will step in and fix this problem.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a law. It could be changed. Right, Lewis Gutentag? I mean, couldn't it just be changed?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Congress could provide for a better process for individuals who are arriving to claim asylum. The problem is that in 1996, it went in the opposite direction and essentially limited those opportunities. And now what this case shows is that even under that very limited process, the government's not following the law, it's not applying the right legal standard, and then the court is not enforcing or reviewing what's actually happened. But Congress could certainly step in and restore a better process and ensure that courts have an opportunity to review negative decisions, as has always been the case. There's never been a time in our history when the government's been allowed to act arbitrarily to violate the law, and the individual who's subjected to that process has had no opportunity to go to court to challenge that wrongful deportation or expulsion order.
Lee Gallant, you said that the need for judicial oversight has increased because of the Trump administration's push for deportation. Is this where the separation of powers comes in?
I think that's absolutely right.
You know, I think we always need judicial oversight, but right now we need it more than ever because the underlying asylum process is being eviscerated almost completely by the Trump administration. And so if they are not going to properly enforce the laws that Congress has passed, we need judicial oversight. It's exactly right. It's a separation of powers problem. And it goes to the rule of law in this country that we have a third branch, the judicial branch, that's supposed to ensure that the executive branch complies with the laws that Congress has passed. And so I think for that reason, Congress has a real vested interest in stepping in and providing judicial review so that the system works as it's supposed to.
The majority's opinion centered on that historical meaning of habeas corpus, which is the right to petition for a day in court. And Justice Sonia Sotomayor said that the majority had damaged the rule of law. Lucas Guttentag, how so?
Well, critically, and I think it's also important to emphasize that on this question of whether or not habeas corpus should be available as a principle for individuals in this situation, the vote was really 5-4. Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg did not join the majority opinion on its very restrictive view of when habeas corpus is available. So they disagreed with the, or they agreed that as to the particular facts of this case and the particular claim that was raised, that maybe a court couldn't review that. But on the broader principle, it did, they did not adopt the majority's reasoning. And what's so critical is that there has to be a mechanism by which courts can ensure that the government is not violating the law. And that's the core principle that is being undermined by this decision that says that a person in the circumstances presented here, person who's arrived, who's in the United States, who's claiming asylum, who under the law is entitled to a certain procedure and a competent decision, can't go to court to challenge that ruling. And without some mechanism for going to court, then the executive branch, as Lee was saying a moment ago, is then left to do whatever it chooses, and particularly under this administration, then there's no check on it's violating the law.
So where's the slippery slope here then, Lee Gallant? Where do you see it? Is it opening some kind of floodgate? Do you see it eroding rule of law?
I think that's exactly the right question. We anticipate, based on the administration's track record, that they will try and use this opinion to then broaden the scope of what the court did. And I think right now, I think the proper reading of the decision and all the court meant to decide is that people right at the border were not entitled to judicial review of these fast-track deportations. But the Trump administration is trying now to expand these fast-track deportations to people who have been living in the interior of the country up to 2 years. That means that they could grab someone out of a cafe in Columbus, Ohio, and say, we don't think you're here illegally. And you wouldn't even get a hearing. You would just be thrown out of the country. We will be pushing back hard to limit this decision. But right now, the ACLU is fighting those cases, fighting the Trump administration's attempt to expand these fast-track deportations. And we anticipate that the administration will come in and say, well, the Supreme Court has blessed this fast-track deportation anywhere in the country. But I think that would be an absolutely wrong reading of this decision. It was limited to the border, and I think that's
and asylum seekers too, right? Asylum seekers specifically.
Well, the case involved asylum seekers. I expect that the administration will seek to apply it beyond asylum seekers. But it's essentially asylum seekers who need this kind of process because people who are coming here just as tourists are not likely to sit in a detention center and want to go through this process anyway. So, you know, there may be occasional cases outside asylum seekers, but essentially this ruling is about asylum seekers. You're right.
The decision came a week after the Supreme Court issued another ruling that President Trump cannot immediately end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which shields people brought to the U.S. as children from deportation and allows them to work. That was a lot of people saw that as a big plus for immigration promotion and a big black eye for the Trump administration. Lucas Guttentag, completely different questions, right?
Yes, and that was a very significant decision, and it protects 700,000 dreamers who have been living in the country, who are dependent on that status, who lives have been changed. So this is not to diminish in any way the significance of that decision, which was profoundly important. But the rule in that case was essentially that the government has to act transparently if it's going to change policies. And it doesn't preclude the Trump administration from trying again. But as the Chief Justice said in that case, the government has to cut square corners. It or can't cut corners, has to make square turns. Mm-hmm. And so it has to be transparent and explain what it's doing. So that, in a sense, was upholding the rule of law. This case undermines the rule of law because it allows the government to act without that judicial oversight, without transparency, and without ensuring that it's actually complying with the law that governs. So the DACA case was very, very important, and it, in some sense, has overshadowed the significance of this case, which so profoundly threatens the rule of law in the immigration process.
We'll continue our conversation. Lucas Gutentag teaches immigration law at Stanford and Yale Law Schools. Also, Lee Gallant is an attorney and the deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project. He argued the case before the U.S. Supreme Court. So stay with us. If you have any questions or comments, if you're seeking asylum and are concerned about how this affects your case, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The U.S. Supreme Court last week ruled that undocumented asylum seekers cannot contest their fast-track deportation orders in federal court. Still with us, Lucas Gutentag, a professor of immigration law at Stanford Law School and Yale Law School, and also Lee Gallant. He is the ACLU attorney who argued the case in the Supreme Court. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. In a statement, the Justice Department called the decision, quote, an important victory for enforcement of the immigration laws, end quote, adding that it, quote, allows the Trump administration to continue to defend our borders, uphold the rule of law, and keep Americans safe. Lee Gallant, what about that? I mean, it's just enabling the administration to do what it needs and what it's chosen as its goal to do.
Right. Well, I think so. It goes to a larger point that the administration has tried now to end asylum essentially at the southern border, including for children, and nothing about having habeas corpus would it prohibit the government from enforcing the law. It would just ensure that the government enforces the law properly. So these hearings would have been very short and very quick, and the judge would have just simply said, well, did you follow the law? If you followed the law, deportation would have occurred, but it would have prevented those erroneous deportations. And remember, this all sounds very technical about habeas corpus and can sound very, very abstract, but we're talking about people whose lives hang in the balance. And I think it's important for the American public to remember that right now it's Central Americans principally at the southern border who need our help, but it's been different groups in our country throughout history who have benefited from asylum. And I think we are really at a dangerous point in America if we are going to abandon the protections for people fleeing danger. After World War II, we in the world said, never again will we turn our back on people. That's exactly what we're doing now. And so this case, if we had prevailed, would simply have ensured that people were not sent back to danger and possibly death if they weren't supposed to be under the laws. It would have just been a check against incorrect deportations. It would not have prohibited deportations, even of asylum seekers.
I'm still trying to understand, Lee, that the person reviewing the case in the first place said he believed what your client said about his fears about returning and how he had been tortured and so forth, but then refused to let him stay. What was the disconnect there?
So you're exactly right to be confused. So this is what happened. They believe that he'd been abducted, beaten senseless, ended up in the hospital, that he was Tamil, understood that Tamils are historically persecuted. But they said, well, you didn't tell us exactly who did it. So, and this is all just sort of checking, the Tamils are just checks boxes. So it's another reason you don't really know what's exactly going on. But what we were able to piece together is that the Asamoas apparently didn't believe that it was government officials and said, well, these could have been just private people beating you up, and therefore you're not entitled to asylum. But that was implausible, as the Supreme Court suggested, because everything about his case fit the exact pattern of government persecution in Sri Lanka. They abducted him in a van. There's a phenomenon in Sri Lanka called the white van phenomenon, where government officials abduct Tamils and blindfold them and then beat them and torture them. He had repeatedly said, I was arrested, meaning government officials. Uh-huh. But they asked him, well, who did this to you? And he, of course, didn't know the specific names. And so that's the kind of thing that if we were able to go into court, he had his day in court, a judge would have scratched their head just like you're doing right now and said, well, how did he not make out his case? And remember, these fast-track deportations, Congress said, you only have to make out an initial case. You don't have to make out your whole case.
Uh-huh.
For them to say, well, you didn't make out your whole, even an initial case based on all these facts, was implausible. And we would have won had we had our day in court.
And so when I hear about people seeking asylum from like South American countries where they're being targeted by, you know, gangs and organized crime and that kind of a thing, that's not government either, is it?
So the test is not just whether it's government,
okay,
it's also whether the government can control what's happening.
Okay.
And so what historically has been the case, although the Trump administration is trying to overturn it, is if you have a gang in Central America that's controlling the whole town, setting curfews, taxing people, and the official government can't control that, that has always historically been sufficient to make out asylum, because the government is unable,
okay,
or unwilling to control the persecution by private individuals. And now the Trump administration is trying to undermine that as well. So we are really looking at a potential sea change in asylum, not just whether there's going to be oversight by the courts, but even the types of claims you can bring. The latest thing from the Trump administration is that gender discrimination claims, gender persecution will not be sufficient. So we're essentially seeing the Trump administration trying to end asylum in this country.
Justice Alito wrote in the majority opinion that an immigrant at the threshold of initial entry cannot claim any greater rights under the Due Process Clause. So does that mean, Lucas Guttentag, that no due process until an immigrant is legally processed and authorized to be in the U.S.?
Well, it's a little murky based on the way the court wrote the decision, but that's the danger. But so there's an old doctrine which is very highly criticized since it was adopted in the 1950s as itself being incorrect under longstanding precedent. But it is the case that what the court has said in the past, if someone's arriving for the first time at a port of entry, whether it's at land or at an airport, that individual does not have a due process right to challenge the mechanisms by which the person's expelled. Now, what's happened here is that the government said, well, we're going to apply this doctrine, this highly criticized doctrine, we're going to apply it to someone who's physically in the United States, crossed the border, admittedly illegally, but crossed the border and is physically present here. This doctrine has never been applied in that situation. And what's critical here is that there is our legal rules, standards, statutes, the asylum statute, the Refugee Act of 1980, that requires that a certain procedure be followed. And the court has always said that the procedures that Congress prescribes, that the law says has to be followed, that is enforceable by a person, even arriving at a port of entry. You can't challenge the statute as violating due process if you're just entering, but you have a right to enforce the statute as written. And that's what Mr. Thoracic, in this case, was trying to do. He was saying, I'm entitled to a proper initial screening that complies with the legal standard, that determines whether or not I'm allowed to apply for a full-blown asylum hearing. And the process, that initial screening process, the way it was conducted, the result that was issued for the reasons that you were just hearing, that violated the law. violated the legal standard, it violated the procedures I'm entitled to. So I'm trying to enforce the law as written. And what the Trump administration is trying to do, this is not that the Trump administration is trying to enforce that this provision, that this decision allows the Trump administration to enforce the immigration laws. The problem is that the Trump administration is violating the immigration laws as written, and the purpose of the courts is to enforce that law as written, and that's what this case challenges.
You raised the Refugee Act of 1980?
Yes.
Is that in conflict with the 1996 law?
Well, that's a very good question, and it certainly is in many respects. There's an attempt to try to reconcile the two, and the way the two are to be reconciled is through this initial screening process,
okay,
which is to say that if someone arrives at the border and they're subject to immediate expulsion, if they claim a fear of returning, then they have to have this initial screening to determine whether or not they're going to be allowed to apply for asylum. And that's the mechanism by which Congress tried to both have a fast-track deportation process and to respect the Refugee Act. Now, in practice, there are real problems with that, and it's not actually effectively protecting individuals who have a right to apply for asylum, but the attempt is for the law to reconcile the two through this critical threshold screening, the so-called credible fear process, that was at issue in this case.
Let's see. Stephen and Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Ann. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
So my question to you and your guests sort of twofold. One, do you think there will be ramifications from the international community as potentially viewing this decision and the actions of the Trump administration as a human rights violation going forward? And additionally, do you think this is such a partisan issue as it will get traction and discussion in the upcoming presidential debates?
I'm Louis Gutentag.
I think that it's hard to know what the ramifications are going to be for the international community. The international human rights bodies, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and others, you know, that are concerned with these, with enforcing the Refugee Act and the international treaties on which they're based, are, I think, highly critical of this decision. I don't know that they've spoken out directly, but they have. But the importance of having a meaningful asylum protection, that's been reiterated again and again and again by the international human rights bodies, that the United States has that obligation under the Refugee Act, under the international convention. So in that respect, I think, yes. Whether this rises to the level of a partisan issue, you know, it's very hard to say. We'll see how the campaign evolves. We're obviously at a time of, incredible concern about the pandemic, about the economy. But there's a growing understanding that the Trump administration's immigration policies at the border, in particular with regard to asylum seekers, is wrong, and that its treatment of immigrants as a whole is wrong, and that it's part of the divisive strategy of the Trump administration. And so in that respect, I think absolutely the question of immigration, fair treatment of non-citizens, respect for the asylum process, and respect for the rule of law will be front and center in the campaign.
Well, how does the U.S. compare to other developed countries in this issue, Lucas?
Well, I'm not the best expert to comprehensively survey, what goes on around the world, but the United States has been criticized for its various policies, including the most recent one for expelling people at the border under the Public Health Authority rather than providing asylum screening for them. But on the whole, the international community wants and insists on a proper and fair asylum process for people, including arriving at the border. Not every country does that great. There have been lots of controversies in Europe about that. The United States has historically been, at the forefront of providing those protections, and now it's moving to the back. And that's a sad statement about where we are, and it's inconsistent with the principles that we've espoused. since the Refugee Convention was first adopted in the international community in 1951.
Lee Gelernt, anything to add there?
Yeah, I think that what we've seen is increasingly the international community condemning the Trump administration's asylum policies. And as Lucas just mentioned, the most recent policy that's not getting a lot of attention and sliding under the radar, I think, a little bit, is this new policy they've enacted where they're not giving people any asylum hearings. Forget not getting a full asylum hearing. They're not even getting fast-track asylum hearings. People are just being expelled, tens of thousands of people, automatically based on the administration's claim that it's necessary for safety because of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And we have challenged that as a pretext, that, and including children who are being expelled automatically without any hearing. And so we have challenged that and had a preliminary ruling saying the administration is exceeding its authority. But I wanted to connect that to your question, the caller's question about the international community,
mm-hmm.
because the international community has condemned that, including the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugee, that has said that is out of line with international standards. During a pandemic, you must quarantine people, not send them back to danger. And what we cited in our briefs in the court is that European countries are specifically exempting asylum seekers and children from any bans based on COVID-19. And yet the Trump administration is expelling even children based on the pandemic rather than quarantining them. And so I think the Trump administration for roughly the entire 4 years has been out of step with the international community. And one thing I would say about whether it rises to the level of a partisan issue, my own feeling is that these issues can be somewhat technical and the border can be sort of out of sight, out of mind.
Mm-hmm.
But what we've found is the more the public learns about the individual stories, the more they care when it becomes less an abstraction and they understand who are these people fighting. So when we brought the family separation lawsuit, when the administration a couple of years ago was separating little children from their families, mm-hmm. and people started hearing from the families and the children, people were outraged, and not just Democrats and liberals, but Republicans and conservatives as well. Laura Bush came out, the Pope came out, conservative religious leaders. And so I think it's going to be our task to show who are these asylum seekers, that they're not here gaming the system, that they are genuinely fleeing danger, just as past groups in America have fled danger since World War II, and to really show that. And I think once people see the human side of this, they will care more.
How do you do that?
That's a good question, and it's not easy, but I think it's getting these individual stories out there, explaining both the rule of law aspect, but saying, here's this family, getting them on TV or on the radio and saying, this is what I was fleeing. This is who I am. This is why I want to come to the United States. But that's a lot of work, and it's difficult, and the administration and the president obviously have a bigger bully pulpit. And they can get their narrative out that all these people are dangerous or just trying to come here and benefit from the system. And what gets lost is the human dimension, like our client, who was fleeing grave danger and was just trying to escape like people have always tried to escape in the past.
And we just have about 30 seconds left, Lee, and I'm sorry to do this to you, but what happens to your client now? Is he gone?
No, he's still here, and we believe that the administration should reconsider his decision. We can't go to court, but the administration can always reconsider the decision, and the Supreme Court seems to be suggesting that the administration should, based on the facts. So we're hoping that he will be allowed to remain here, especially because things have gotten much worse in Sri Lanka, even since we brought the case, much worse for Tamils.
Well, Lee Gelernt, attorney, deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Lucas Gutentag teaches immigration law at Stanford Neal Law Schools. Thanks to you as well. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's it for now. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.